Welcome back to Compliments to the Chef. I'm your host, Nancy.
And I'm your host, Bits.
And we have reached the end of our stay in Canada.
Aloha.
Why did you say aloha?
I don't know. I am, well, because it means hello and goodbye.
And okay, fair.
In this context, fair. I meant goodbye. au revoir.
Au revoir. Yeah, I think that makes more sense. We got there. Yeah, it's been a fun run. Obviously, we're going to talk about this episode in the
recap. We're going to talk about this episode.
Yes, we will get into it in our recap bits. Thank you very much for reminding me what it is that we are here to do. But before we get into it, because that is what we are here to do, I believe we have some leftovers. So I have just one leftover from last week, and we got into a bit of a tête-à-tête, you might say, on the size of a silver dollar pancake.
Bet your bottom dollar.
Bet your bottom dollar. Bet your silver dollar. There is actually a pretty definitive answer on this. The silver dollar pancake is a type of mini pancake originated in the United States in the 1800s. Their name comes from being about the same size as a pre-1979 U.S. silver dollar coin, which is roughly 1.5 inches in diameter.
Oh, that's a small. You were right. That's a small.
It's a small pancake, but that's a pancake. Big coin. Oh, it says, however, over time.
Small pancake, big coin.
Big coin. Okay, however. Oh, I didn't read the second half of the sentence. Over time, the size of a silver dollar pancake has increased slightly. And they are now typically around 3 inches wide.
Adjusted for inflation. And we're both right because that's how I think of silver dollars. I think they are like a bit, you know, I actually thought they were the size of a sand dollar, you know, like when you see
sand.
The,
yeah. Gosh, I love when we are both right. It's such a nice feeling.
It's so nice. Keep it coming, universe.
Universe, thank you for giving us that beautiful moment of harmony. But we have one final leftover, and this is a fun one. Faithful listeners to the pod, because we have a very devoted fan base, will recall that a few weeks ago, Bits and I outwardly discussed that we have no idea what the terminology of expoing is all about and how it works. And we said, wouldn't it be cool if we could get a guest to talk to us about expoing, someone who maybe knows what they're talking about? Will Bits, would you believe it?
I wouldn't if I wasn't there.
We have our very first and a very special guest leftover from season 22 Top Chef contestant semi-finalist Lana Lagomarsini. Take it away.
Okay, so I can tell from my personal experience how it works. So I worked expo at Danielle I was on that station for about a year. Wow. So definitely is a delicate balance. But basically, so you go to a restaurant, you place an order, the server will punch the order in the ticket machine. And the ticket machine. I'm so
the doodad.
I'm so eloquent. Wow. She's as you guys said, she's beauty and she's grace. But yeah, so they put the order in, you get the order, especially if it's like something that's multi-course. So let's say you want like a salad and then like your entree and then dessert, whatever. So we call the ticket and you say, okay, so table 53 on order, which means like order in is usually what people will say. So let's say, you know, salad, aunt leg, steak, whatever. Just so you guys know, on Meatline, order in, like, that means start cooking it, essentially. Mm-hmm. Like, cook it pretty much most of the way there, especially if you're coming from, you know, you're coming from raw. Start getting that steak on, but hold it, you know, until the order's on fire, right? So, but the salad's on fire. And basically, the order in means it's ordered. The fire means go on it, essentially.
Oh,
okay. So if I say, okay, order in salad, steak, like, you know, like, and then after that, pastry. Whatever. So, but fire salad right now. That means start working that salad. Steak heard me. They got to go. But also, like, we're going to wait on that. If something is out, for instance, I heard you guys asking, like, what 86 means. 86 means it's out. Like, you don't have any more. Like, let's say we're running a special. Special steak, just order in. I just sold the last one. Call the server and please tell them we're 86. Like, yeah. Meaning, like, we don't have it anymore. Like, it's nowhere to be found. It's gone. So that's what that means. And then what were the other questions that you
what
had?
Is all day?
Yes.
Oh, all day. That's right. Oh, it's so funny because I feel like being a chef is like kind of like being a lawyer. Like there's like its own specific jargon that comes with it. And all day is something that I use all the time and don't realize that people have no idea what I'm talking about. All day means in total. So let's say you have 4 steaks here, 3 steaks there, and 6 steaks there. You have all day 13 steaks on fire. Like, okay, I have 14 steaks on order, you know, whatever. Like, but you have steak. It just means the total number, essentially.
Oh.
So I need 2 steaks for 53. I need 4 steaks for 57. What's my all day on that? 6.
So to bring this to like something like Restaurant Wars, why does Restaurant Wars always go sideways because of expoing? Like, what are the like main culprits of why expoing and Restaurant Wars is like sometimes oil and water?
Well, listen, I'm going to tell you, expoing goes hand in hand with servers, right? Expediter is the liaison between back of house and front of house. So if one of those two parts, either the back or the front, is not, you know, meeting the standard, then it doesn't matter how good the expo is, you know?
Right.
Like, if I told this server that the special is 86 and you're still ringing it in, then now you gotta come back in the kitchen and now you gotta go to the table and explain to them that you're a dumbass, you know, like, and you didn't listen to me, you know. So it's basically like, you know, it's a team effort. Like, really is a one team effort. So Restaurant Wars, you know, it's your first time working with especially front of house, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
You know, and those types of jobs, they take like, you have to work out the kinks. You know, when I was serving, you know, when I was expoing at Danielle, you know, there'd be one server that was like super communicative. I never had to ask him if he was ready to fire. You know, another server, I knew where he was. He was at his station, but I would just call his station and be like, hey, can I fire? Because he wasn't going to come back and tell me. So I know, you know, but you learn that over time. This one doesn't fire. This one does fire. This one always forgets. So you got to check up on him. You know, it's been 40 minutes in between courses. It's just a soup. What's happening? Like, can I fire the next course? Because like, usually you're not going to fire a course until, you know, you're almost done with the previous course. You kind of want it to like feel seamless when you dine out.
Okay.
You know, you don't want to like finish your soup and then bam, there's your entree. But you also don't want to finish your soup and be like, where's my entree? So it is that. The expo is maintaining that delicate balance. They're marking the times on when your stuff went. And so, you know, if I see something left 20 minutes ago and I know it's not going to take someone, you know, more than like 5 or 10 minutes to eat it, I'll check in with the server. Hey, are they eating slow? What's going on?
Yeah.
You know, am I good to start? Because the next dish is going to take another 7 minutes to pick up. So, you know, can I start going on that or should I wait? You know, you're my eyes and ears out there. What's happening? That kind of stuff. So it's a balance, you know. So when things go sideways on Restaurant Wars, it can be many, you know, there can be many different reasons for it. And, you know, sometimes the servers don't understand what we want on our expo tickets. And sometimes, you know, we can't understand what the server's trying to say, you know. So it's and this happens in real restaurants all the time. You know?
Well, and it's so like, to bring it back to vibes, like sometimes it really is vibes. Like Nancy and I, we were talking the other day about we went and got dinner at Gregory Gourdet's new spot down in Fidei.
Oh, I've been meaning to go there.
Unbelievable. Definitely
run,
go.
Don't
it was
walk.
Awesome.
I'm scooting, you know.
scoot your way.
As soon as I have a free day, I'm in there like swimwear. Like,
But the thing they did so well was service, and they were so like they were high touch in a great way that was, hey, sorry, your dessert's coming. But the thing is, like, we were having such a good time. Like, we didn't even notice, you know what I mean? And I think I can imagine how sometimes it's like, okay, we can, like, stretch this pace a bit because they're kind of settled in and they're relaxing. But I can understand where the art comes from because, you know, if it was any less enjoyable company than Nancy and I was like, oh, my God, get me out of here, like, that may have been different. But I think, you know,
you can just tell. They could just tell, like, okay, they're settled in. They're having a good time.
Exactly. They're in no rush. They're drinking, you know, whatever, like that kind of thing. And that, all of that in a good restaurant, that all is communicated, you know, from front and back of house. Hey, you know what? Can you hold actually on sending first course, because they're going to buy a bottle, you know?
Yeah. And,
okay. Like, I don't want to send the course, because for some reason, once you get the food, people are like, yeah, you know, we'll just get glasses. So you want to make sure that they're ordering the bottle, because it's a team effort. So if the restaurant wins, then the whole team wins, and we all have a job tomorrow.
That.
So, oh my God. You know, you want to hold for wine service, you want to do this. And yeah, so being an expo is, it's a delicate balance that takes, you know, it takes time to really kind of understand how to work an expo line, but it's also like riding a bike, you know, once you learn, you know, expo at one place versus expo at another, essentially still have the same bones, even if it's like, you know, we do things a little different here or here, but it's still basically the same thing, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, getting food to the tables in a timely manner that the guest feels like they're having an experience, they're not rushed, all of that beautiful stuff. And that's hospitality, baby. That's what that is, you know, it goes all the way to the back of house. So
wow.
Well, yeah. Lana, thank you for the most epic guest leftover of all time.
The only guest leftover.
But answered all your questions, you know.
It did. And
make sure, you know, that there's nothing left on the table, so to speak.
Well, I'm going to be using all day at work today. And for those listening, tune in. That was just a sneak peek of our second helping for this week with Lana Lago-Marcini. So tune in on Monday for that full interview.
Yay.
Nancy, I, for one, am so glad I don't have to go one more day of my life without understanding this. I also really do appreciate it, because it gives you a respect for why, when you go to a restaurant and, like, get all your food in at the same time. Like, don't start things. Just, you're messing up the kitchen. Just get your whole order in at once. I personally feel very strongly about that. Like, I don't like when people are like, can we just like put in apps? No, put in your whole meal.
Yes, it gives you an appreciation for why it's really not feasible to do that. And why a restaurant might say, we actually need to take the whole order at the same time.
Yes.
But and I, for one, will never do that again, I think.
I agree. And not to, you know, we spent a ton of time talking to Lana, so definitely tune in on Monday when that full interview goes live. That was just a little moose boosh, if you will.
Oh,
but we had such a fun time talking to her. Just so, the chefs this season are just so a cut above the way that they think about food, the way that they create, the way that they critique. Just, I don't know. I could listen to these chefs talk about their food for hours. But Nancy, I think we got to bring it back to the here and now, because we just had an incredible episode of Top Chef tonight.
Yeah, we gotta talk about it. So Bits, let's begin.
All right, Nancy, kick it off for us. What is your amuse-bouche reaction, episode 12?
My amuse-bouche reaction is, am I crying at the end of this episode of Top Chef? Emotional. What a beautiful, full, rich episode. Here's the thing. We're at the point in time where there really aren't a lot of chefs, so each of them gets a ton of camera time. But I did not feel that it was overkill this episode. I loved each moment that we spent with the chefs. I loved really getting a sense of how their dishes were going. And it left me just so overwhelmed with joy and sadness at the end. What about you?
Nancy, I couldn't agree more. This episode, to me, was the best episode of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Full stop. Yes. I think there is something about the way it was just the perfect encapsulation of what makes this season so great. You have the lyricism with which these people talked about their food, expressed their food, critiqued the food of the chefs.
Mm-hmm.
It was truly emotional. There's this just joining of
like-minded souls in this stunning backdrop of the of wilderness, of nature. There's this proximity to the ingredient that just makes everything, just like ratchets up everything. And through all that, it's like, it's not dissimilar to like a prestige drama where at this point we're so close to these characters, for lack of a better word. We are rooting for their development, their character development. And like any good show, you know, there's some sort of inciting incident. There's a, like, there's a thing that you want to watch and see, like, okay, how are they going to react to this one? And so we got that this episode. We saw each of these chefs continue to push through their distinct point of view, even through a challenge that was coming at them with a really kind of highly opinionated prompt. And I just, everything about this episode is what I love about Top Chef. It was the perfect storm of what makes this show great. And truly, I think that this might have been the best episode of the last two seasons. Like,
wow. I think I would agree in that final statement. But yeah, you put it perfectly. It was a beautiful culmination of the time in the location, firstly, which we always joke, does it really matter where Top Chef goes? Is it here? Is it there? But I think it really honored Canada. Yes. And it really gave these chefs a platform to shine. And I think that no other group of chefs could have taken on this challenge and done such an exceptional job.
Yes.
It was great. It was great, great, great. So let's dive into it. The first thing I would like to bring up, not Cesar making little animals out of his bananas. This, let's talk about cute, okay? Ugh. That man embodies cuteness in all of it. And I did love that, first off, this episode started and finished with tears. We had the whole crew getting very emotional over Lana's exit, which we were emotional as well. But I love that they said, let's make it cute in honor of Lana. And they like keep that spirit going. I did count there were four cutes this episode. So we are keeping it going. But you know,
I just also just love Massimo's like, I can, I'll girl talk with you.
Yeah. Oh. He's like, I'm a girl dad. I loved it. I loved the whole thing. God, I feel like maybe we should just end the episode right now. That was a very beautiful summation of thoughts about this episode. But I guess we can dive into it.
I do declare. Well, we didn't have a quick fire, you know, getting into the kind of like practical run of show here. No quick fire this episode. We got a beautiful drive out into the Canadian wilderness in the ultimate driving machine. I will not ever not call a BMW the ultimate driving machine.
If you, it's illegal not to.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're right. We should make that a thing too.
Straight to jail.
Shout out BMW. Give us free cars.
Please sponsor us.
Coming out the gate real hot. No sponsor to BMW, the ultimate
going
driving machine.
For the title sponsor of the show.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, so yes, we come out in this beautiful wilderness and we are greeted by Kristen Kish, looking fabulous in like a hiking chic outfit. And we are also, she's accompanied by Brenda Holder and Tracy Little. Brenda Holder is a native to that land. She is a master forager of the crops that are grown there and that exist there in their wildest form.
Yeah, her Tracy, kind of like official was, she's a Cree knowledge keeper.
Yes, thank you. And then we have Tracy Little, who is a local chef, also a master forager. And she is an expert in all of these plants as well and uses them in her daily cooking. So it really was just an incredible start to the day. It was very funny. What did you make of when she asked like people or everyone, how do you feel about nature? And Tristan goes, it doesn't call to me.
I know. He likes a roof. Yeah, honestly, like that, Massimo's the same way. He's like, I love hiking and smoking cigarettes.
Yeah. He's like, but without the hike. But Massimo also at the end was like, I'm an outdoorsman. I am a cowboy.
It was in the way that it was like fun to see their personalities are just like the foil there, mm-hmm. I just couldn't help but think, wow, this one is for Cesar. He was a kid in a candy shop.
He was so excited.
Bugging. And it was awesome to see. And it was just the alchemy of this group, these five chefs, this episode mm-hmm. was really, I think also just to the earlier points we've made, like really added to that. I don't know what it was, just the vibes were so right.
Yes.
But back to the foraging piece. So pretty straightforward elimination challenge if you think foraging is straightforward. If you don't, maybe it's not so straightforward, but they had to create a dish using foraged ingredients. We get a little bit of a kind of preamble on foraging, what that means from, you know, consider all the way down to the root. And I think, you know, I don't know if I've talked to you about this before, but we've talked about up in the cabin, we have my husband and I have a cabin up in the woods in upstate. And we've talked in the past about, you know, wanting to bring in some expert like forager to help us understand like what grows on the land, et cetera. And so I went onto Reddit. This was like probably a year ago. Basically asked like r/foraging, which is our awesome community, like, hey, do you know, can someone come out here and tell me like what we can't eat and what we can eat? And so when they were running through this and talking a bit about what was growing and what was there to forage, I got kind of curious to see, you know, how does that compare? Obviously, we're talking about like the Northeast versus Calgary, Alberta specifically, like what the differential is there. And so I have a little bit of little fun. I don't know that they're fun facts, but maybe like a shallow dive into foraging.
Oh, okay. Give it to me.
So Nancy, you will not be a stranger to this information, but in the Northeast, the springtime, we've got ramps, we've got fiddleheads, we've got morel mushrooms. In Canada, where the chefs are hanging out, there's a lot later of a start, and that's generally because it's cold as hell and stuff can't grow there. But a lot of what they have to work with is wild greens. Asparagus also came up, but I don't know that I saw any asparagus on the plate
tonight.
I don't
think we got any asparagus.
But then summer is a pretty short season as well. We have the Saskatoons, which we saw last episode. We have a lot more mushrooms. Fall and winter are also like a fairly brief harvest as far as foraging goes in that region. So there's rose hips, which we saw, roots, which we saw. Conifers is more on the winter side. So kind of this like winter to spring transitional moment that I'm imagining they're in is probably mm-hmm. why we saw a lot of conifer. I mean, for us, where we're at as we move into the summer here, that looks like wild greens, chanterelle mushrooms, berries. And then fall is unsurprisingly like nuts, fungi that grows like later in the year. Mm-hmm. And then we too have our conifers in the winter. So next year we can go smoke fish on pine needles.
Let's
if
do
we
it.
Want.
I have some thoughts based on what you just said. The first is, have you ever seen a photo of asparagus growing?
I don't like it at all. It seems fake. It seems like like a deep fake.
It seems like if someone made a joke of how asparagus grow in the ground, it's really just an open field with single asparagi shooting up out of the ground. It's
but can so you can you conceive of a less disturbing way for it to grow? Because you can't.
No. Yeah, it's just wild
it
the way
it grows.
It just needs
to kind of just come into existence all at once.
Yes. Yes. What if it like came out of trees and like hung down from the trees?
I like that.
That would be pretty weird.
It's like wind chimes.
Like, yeah, vines. So that was my first thought when you were saying that. My second thought has escaped me. So all I'll say is something that I absolutely loved was the image of Cesar holding up his 15-pound mushroom as if it were a fish that he caught in the sea.
Yes.
And I was like, you know what? I will make fun of men for having a photo of a fish trophy in their Tinder profile. But if I come across Cesar and he's holding up a mushroom, I'm swiping right. I think it is a beautiful thing to see a man and his mushroom.
Don't come in between them. Well, to that point, let's talk a bit about like what these chefs were hauling out of the ground, because you know, yeah. we're down to five chefs. I feel like we should take our time with the kind of progression of this episode. So
yeah.
We're in the foraging, we're in the fields, luckily we're getting a little bit of a instructional moment, because I was like, this could be like low-key super dangerous.
So dangerous.
Or like
someone will die.
Best, someone is highly disadvantaged, and at worst, someone will die. You will kill Tom. Mm-hmm. You know what's funny? So ants was a big piece. Both Shuai and Cesar got amped up on the ants. So I don't know if like this is ironic, but surprisingly, as listeners know, Nancy and I watch other seasons of Top Chef in our free time. I just got to the finale of Gregory and May's season in San Miguel de Allende.
And that's a great finale.
It's so good. It is a really good finale. But they're cooking with ants. They're making like they're actually making what Cesar describes. So I was like, wow, okay, that was crazy timing. We had some rose hip.
Have you ever eaten bugs?
No. I'm okay. No. Like, I'm okay. I don't know. I'm okay.
I've had crickets. Like, I went to Marfa with my mom many years ago, where we happened to meet a young Aparna from Indian Matchmaker. I've told you that story.
Oh, right.
That's an incredibly random story for another podcast. Before she was famous, we met her. And my mom stayed in touch with her and remains friends with Aparna from Indian Matchmaker.
I love
Shout out to my mom. But we also, it was the Agave Festival in Marfa, Texas. And we went to some local lunch that they were putting on, and they served cricket tacos. My mom did not try them, but I did. It was essentially just a little crunch.
Look. Was it like, what's the closest? Like chicken
it felt
skin?
Like when what? You... No, honestly, the closest thing I would equate it to was at the bottom of a bag of chips, like the crumbly parts. Like just, it was like just really tiny, crunchy things. Like a rice puff, perhaps. So anyway, that's when I ate bugs. But let's talk about when Cesar and Shuai ate bugs, because they were getting hyped. They were bugging on the bugs. They taste like lemon. And of course, everyone, Bailey's like, I'm good. Like, I'm really good on the bugs. She expressed her limits.
Cool without him. I'm kind of with Bailey on this one. I know. I like get it. Like,
yeah.
It's like not cool, but I don't know. I don't need it. There's enough other stuff to eat. So I'll wait till this is like a, what's that movie? Like a Snowpiercer situation, and I have to eat them to survive.
Hopefully it doesn't get to that, although the way tariffs are going, it might. But let's move on. We'll all be foraging then. Let's talk so... So what's really interesting about Tristan is for the first time really this season, we see him expressing a really deep disorientation is how I would put it with these ingredients. He understands intellectually what the challenge is, and he knows sort of a kind of direction, but he expresses that he feels really disconnected from the heart of this challenge and can't really figure out how to inject himself into it. What did you think of the way he handled it and what he ended up coming up with?
It's interesting. You know, I think it's, I really liked that. I really liked that we got to like kind of pause on this moment of him being a bit destabilized. And it is interesting that it comes, you know, so much of his style is rooted in place, but it's rooted in the story of a place. And I think for that to be the case, it's rooted in the people of the place. And so when you take him kind of out of that context and into literally the wilderness with nobody for miles and miles and miles, like if the place and the land and the, like, if that is the jumping off point, I kind of got why there was like an initial disconnect, right? Because there wasn't a sense of people in that place, because there certainly was. And we got that with our sort of like guest judges that we met in Brenda and Tracy. But I think that's kind of how I maybe incorrectly read into it.
But
I really loved the way that it's just, and this is like anybody who's just incredible at what they do, just like a creative genius type.
Yes.
It's nothing, nothing, nothing. And then the moment when it clicks and it's like, boop. And it just, everything snaps into place. Yes. And that he was able to pull that thread through, and we'll talk about it when we get to the food. Mm-hmm. It was really nice, but I do think, like, at this stage in the episode, especially alongside Bailey, who I think is in a similar
– yeah.
I think in a similar headspace of just – but we've seen that from Bailey before. And actually, I think in a lot of ways, Bailey's like – she's not a procrastinator, but I think she's successful in the way that some people who are inclined to procrastinate are, and that it's like just remove every other possible – like, push me up against the wall – put me under, like, the time gun, and, like, I'll figure it out. And I think there's something in her style that – or something that this sort of environment has really unlocked in her with the just sort of, like, necessity of creativity.
Yep, I totally agree. Why don't we dive into what they made in their cooking process? Because I think that, you know, we can talk around it, but I think it's really great to think about where all of their minds went. I think in general – the strategy here on this challenge was take these ingredients, extrapolate them into something that these unfamiliar ingredients, extrapolate them into something familiar, and then execute accordingly. I think that we saw Bailey take this approach. I think we saw Tristan take this approach. I think to an extent we saw, or we definitely saw Cesar take this approach. Totally. I would say that Massimo and Schwei are the only ones who really, not only, but took a different strategy, which was like treat the ingredients as they are in their pure form and make a dish out of them as is, as opposed mm-hmm. to trying to relate it to a bigger idea or imitate something else using these ingredients. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And here's, I mean, we got to say this at the front. Every single one of these chefs made not only a good dish, but also an exceptional dish.
Yeah.
They all exceeded expectations. They all did a great job. And so given their level of talent, there was no right or wrong approach here. They took it. They interpreted it. I would say most people interpreted it one way. Massimo and Schwei did another. But they all were successful. And so let's maybe talk a little bit about the dishes in the order that they arrived to the judges.
One thing to maybe linger on, which I think was, I was really missing this, which is, we need to talk about the Tom of this episode.
Yes, and I know. I was going to get to it.
I kind of left this out of the amuse-bouche, but I think it's a critical element mm-hmm. to why this was perfect Top Chef, because you had a incandescently happy Tom.
Yes.
And I this started all the way back when we have the Tom walkthrough in the outdoor kitchen setup.
I have that in my notes too. We finally got a Tom walkthrough this season.
Thank God. It was awesome. I love when he like steps to the side and like gives his like quick take. Mm-hmm. When this was happening, Nancy, I had the thought, I was like, oh my God, we haven't talked about Tom's hats all season. Has he just not been wearing hats until this episode?
Oh my God, get Charlotte on the horn.
Talk about it.
He's definitely worn hats this season.
I just can't believe, I mean, we just haven't noticed. And maybe that's the sign of a great hat.
Audience, I'm sorry that we failed you. We haven't even remarked on Tom's hats this season.
But he was rocking the beanie this ep.
Yes.
And he was rocking also the beanie at the right. Yeah, he was rocking it the right way.
Oh, I was going to say he was also rocking a tie-dye scarf.
Oh, yes.
Just a delightful outfit on Tom.
Really nice.
Was clearly very excited about this episode, and he was very excited about the results of this episode. And I think he sort of – he made a I need to hold on to it because he made a comment at Judge's table that just like blew me away kind of. But I loved in this Tom walkthrough when – Massimo was like, do you want to go catch some trout in that river? And you could tell Tom was like, are we allowed to do that? Like, I would love to do that.
Yeah.
Tom, the fisherman, really came to play.
Like, are you serious? Like, not no. no, I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. You're right. Okay. So I just needed to put that thought into the ether. I know we're going to come back to Tom, but yeah, let's get into the food.
So the first dish we have arriving to the table.
We have Tristan, like we said, taking a forage Jamaica, excuse me, almost like a forage Jamaica approach. He put out an OG jerk pork, plantain miso glaze. He did the sort of foraged ingredients. He had poplar bark as like the cinnamon element, yarrow as the thyme. He had callaloo and coal roasted roots. So he was playing with like the parsnip puree as like a coconut milk dupe. Puree is maybe not the right.
He made like a parsnip milk the way you would make coconut milk. I loved it when he left the table. Everyone's collective reaction was, I could listen to Tristan talk all day.
Yes.
He just has such a commanding presence.
His like decision to describe it or like the insert, he's like, I just thought of wild pigs just like rooting around. I love that. I'm like, he's holding that at the same time he's kind of holding this like more just longer field of vision on this is, you know, Jamaican foraging, Jamaican flavors. I mean, such a strong start. Agree. Like, honestly, the comment made for him, this, I could listen to him talk about food all day. I would say that to this entire episode. The way that people spoke about the food in this episode was just so crisp and beautiful. There was such a poetry to it.
Yes.
Honestly, every single dish and the way that I've already said all this, but like even just the way the chefs presented it. And so this moment was just really beautiful because we had to be able to taste like the guest judge saying, I'm just astounded how you could translate food from this land to where you're from.
Mm-hmm.
Like completely different flavors. And I just, I don't know, no notes. Like it just was such a beautiful commentary.
Yes, I agree. I think that for the people who are local to that region, my guess is that they're very used to using those ingredients. They're very familiar with those ingredients and the traditions that they come from. And it's sort of this moment where not like a mirror is held up to them, where they are just presented with, you know what I would liken it to? And I'm sorry that this is a ridiculous comparison, but I once was at a barbecue and there were what I believed to be cupcakes on the table, and I took a bite into it, and it was a cornbread muffin with butter on top, not a cupcake. And I was – the sensory experience of it was so odd. But as we know on this pod, we love cornbread. So I wasn't mad about the experience, but it was just this
– love.
This idea of not deception in a malicious way, but expecting one thing and getting another can be so mind-blowing with a piece of food. And I think that I can't speak for them, but what I was getting from their commentary about Tristan's dish, but it was just this completely unexpected translation of things that they are so familiar with.
Yeah.
And it was just really fun to see. Specifically on the dish, they said the sauce was balanced perfectly. It was exceptional. And he just knocked it out of the park. And of course, he's the first one to go. So he sets the bar super high. But then, as luck would have it, every single chef exceeded expectations as we kept going on in this episode. So you never have to worry about a clunker. And next up, we had Cesar, who was really excited. He took, as I said, a similar approach to Tristan, taking these ingredients and translating them into something that's familiar to them, to him and his upbringing. So he decided to use the ingredients and make a play on a al pastor / conchita pibil, which are treatments of different types of meat commonly used in tacos and Mexican cuisine. So he made a mushroom trompo with mushroom pibil broth and toasted ants.
Cesar, this whole episode to me was just like a mad scientist. Yes. Like I just got the impression that he just was like in his lab tinkering and everything like I wouldn't have been surprised if he just forgot everybody else was there because he was so locked in. It was so I just felt like this challenge was made for him. And it was really fun to see him work. It was fun to see just you know what to expect from Cesar and that you never know what to expect from Cesar. Like,
yes.
Of course he was going to go with the ants. And I just, he drove a lot of the sort of like joy for this episode.
Yes.
To and see that like see, yeah. huge branch.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Skewer branch.
In the plating of the dish even, it was so playful, but so thoughtful.
Yeah.
And really respected the ingredients. To me, this was Cesar's pickled dessert moment, you know, part deux. It was so clever and so interesting and such a perfect encapsulation of the challenge, a Gesamtkunstwerk of sorts. And I think that he, once he did the pickled dessert and was validated in the way that he was validated on the pickled dessert, I think it really gave him confidence to continue to indulge those instincts inside of him. And I think that he's, at that point, he's always done really silly things. We always know Cesar is going to do something out of the box. But this was, I thought, a beautiful full circle moment where it all came together in a stellar execution. And
fun.
He just landed the plane so well on this dish.
I am... you know, zooming out and just a moment to kind of reflect on the vibes at the table, this like dining table.
Beautiful tablescape, by the way. Once beautiful again, Aisha, thank you for your work.
Thank you, Aisha. Beautiful tablescape, but also just the energy. Sometimes the ensemble that you find at the dining table, the judges' table, just really clicks. And this week was one of those episodes where everybody there was speaking at the same – everybody there was operating on the same frequency of reverence and just, like, thoughtfulness. And I just was really – it was just very fun to hear the commentary. There was so much just joy and happiness in the experience. Tom – straight up, like, I love my job so much. Like, and these are the episodes where, you know, when we see episodes where Tom is sort of like, Tom kind of like faded into the background on that one. And you're sort of like, maybe he just like didn't have any notes. And then you see one of these episodes and you're like, oh no, this is Tom on it. And it's just, oh, it's like the giddiest feeling. It just imparts something.
I wonder, you know what, whoever we have come on the pod next, or maybe it's a sore subject, I don't know, but I would love to get their sense of what it's like to watch the judges' reactions, because they're obviously there and they hear the commentary at judges' table, but I bet it must feel great being one of these five chefs watching this episode and seeing how giddy Tom is and the effusiveness of their praise.
I love that question for the reason that you've stated, but also because I've noticed in my side viewing of the
your
Gregory
second helping
Gourdet,
of your own episodes.
No. Not even double dipping on this episode, which I did. I did watch this episode twice. I am watching the Boston, Top Chef Boston, and something I think that the chefs have started to do, whether on purpose or just evolution, we've been conditioned, is they stop speculating on what the judges think of their food.
Yeah.
Because like you watch that season and they're like, it was amazing, I stuck the landing. And the judges are like, this fucking sucked. Like, and so I think they just kind of learn to hedge their bets and just be like, I don't know. Could have gone
either
way.
That's a good point. We don't really, I mean, the cliche of like cook your food has sort of become so ironically ingrained in the Top Chef vocabulary that the way, like, I remember our very first season, I feel like we're getting sentimental because this episode was so sentimental, but we asked Jen Carroll, like, how do you balance cooking your food and cooking for the judges? And she sort of rolled her eyes and laughed and she was like, at the end of the day, you really got to cook for the judges. And I think that just the evolution of Top Chef, I think the judges have gotten more mature and are not more mature. That's a really patronizing thing to say. I think that they have changed their tune a bit and made allowances for types of cooking that perhaps in the early seasons, when it was a really fine dining focus and Top Chef was about excellence in culinary arts, I just think that the nature of judging has changed, and they have either tacitly or proactively adapted the rubric of how they evaluate dishes.
Yeah.
Based on like, this new generation. I think so. And I think
they're such a mirror to what I think societally we're kind of imposing on these chefs. I think it's also why it's interesting to think about why Top Chef is a show, is not a judged blind show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we kind of like swirled around this on The Last Chance Kitchen with Katiana and Cesar for that singular blind dish. But I think the thing that you miss with that is exactly what I think brings a lot of the soul, especially to an episode like this, where there's a connection between the chef's story, and the food. And you lose that in a world of like blind judging. And I don't know that there's like a right. There isn't. I personally don't think that there's a right or wrong way. Like, I'm sure we could debate on the other side of the fence. But I just think that there is a fullness and a richness that we get because of that. And and you're right. Like, I do think that the judges have just there's been a recalibration, and as our kind of collective awareness of other flavors and other cuisines has just steadily and in some cases just like exponentially risen, Top Chef has kind of always been there to like meet that, to like rise to that. Yeah.
It also, might I say, I think is also not, I don't know that it necessarily meets it. I think that Top Chef has been the platform for a lot of that progress.
Yeah.
I know, like, we're not changing the world here, but like it kind of is. There are so many things that I have learned watching Top Chef. There are so many cultures that I have learned about. There are so many moments in history that I have learned about, and I truly would not know about them were it not for Top Chef. And I think, oh, we could just wax poetic, but I just am grateful for episodes like this and for chefs who go on these shows and really set the standard. But let's get back to the food. Let's talk about Bailey.
I will say that without Top Chef, we wouldn't know what to cook on the Staten Island Ferry.
No, we would never know.
So here's to you.
We'd also never know about Wine Angels.
Oh my God. I got to go to Vegas just so I can go to the Wine Angels thing. That was out of control.
Yes. But okay, let's talk about Bailey. My gosh. So Bailey is the whole episode figuring it out, I would say. As she said, flying by the seat of her pants.
If this was Facebook, it would be, the relationship status would be, it's complicated.
It's complicated. But we see her tinkering all episode, and she finally lands on a dish of a lamb skewer with grilled dandelion salad, Cowtown cow peas, and thistle root puree.
Cowtown, now brown cow.
How now, brown cowtown cow peas?
and cow peas are black-eyed peas.
Yes, I think they're very akin to them.
Which are beans.
Which we've arrived at the beans.
And they are beans, and beans are everything.
And let's talk about how she cooked those beans, because she put them in a Dutch oven and stuck that thing straight on the fire.
Yeah, let her
that
up.
That was cool.
Let her rip and light her up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was fun. I love Cesar's like, hey, Bailey, have you cooked like this before? And she's like, I can't say I have. Yeah. Can we just pause on the fact that we got an outdoor like cooking over an open flame challenge? I think we would have talked about it more if the chefs like weren't good, but because the chefs were really good, it was like
in the slightest.
Yeah, like it wasn't even worth talking about. But like, God, I love an outdoor open flame challenge.
Love. And I think Schwei is a pit master.
Oh my God.
So of course he was in his element. Of course.
You know what? Okay, I will make a plug. One, I think this is the third time. I just watched the episode on the Boston season where they have to make the Thanksgiving dinner.
Yes,
at Plymouth
outside.
Rock or whatever.
oysters.
That was a great challenge. And they're all sweating and dirty and shit. And like, what's the name? Gregory's like making a literal goose in a thatched hut. And like Tom and the guest judge come in, they're like, whoa, hey, you're having a good time. That challenge was unhinged, really good.
How many times can we plug Boston season? I mean, that's in such an A-plus season. So I'll plug it till the
Katsuji, like it's a lot.
I'll plug it to the Cowtown cow peas come home. Let's talk about Bailey's dish. I am the master of the segue.
Yo.
So Bailey's dish, I think on the whole, was excellent. She did a good job with the ingredients. However, the cow peas were ever so slightly undercooked.
This is like the bean equivalent of it just needed one grain of salt.
Yeah.
I hope to reach a point in my life where I can give that advice and people take me seriously. It would have been perfect if it had one more grain of salt.
I was thinking about that actually, and we'll get to it with Massimo, but like the lovely Gail Simmons sometimes says things where I'm like, taken out of context, this is the most pretentious thing that's ever been written.
But that's Top Chef, baby. That's Showbiz Kid. We love it.
We love it. But yeah, so Bailey.
Hers felt like a walk in the woods. What a wonderful point of view to get. And this is, again, so Tom zooms in on this. He's like, she did a great job with the ingredients she was using. There's always some like conflict with flavor that the judges can't quite figure out if they like or not.
With Bailey,
like,
yes.
Yes. It's like I either love it or hate it. And this time it was like the poplar syrup with garlic, I think, was like the mix there. And he's like, I'm not sure if I love it or hate it, but was still absolutely amped to be eating it. So I think that's really interesting. And, you know, I'm kind of sad we already talked to Bailey because I would love to just ask her about that.
I was thinking about that today. I am amazed that we were allowed to talk to Bailey.
Yo, Bailey was like literally in Milan probably like 5 days before I was in Milan. Because I couldn't interview her because I was in Milan.
Not to get too inside baseball, but, you know, like, we have to work with the show to get these guests, and we're so grateful that we do because, like, we are having the time of our lives. But I am amazed that they let Bailey enter. Well, I guess it would have given it away if they hadn't. But right. All to say, are we not lucky to have spoken to a Top Chef season 22 finalist?
While we were playing checkers.
Yeah, they did. I was so okay, we don't have to get into it. But anyway, Bailey did a great job with the exception of a bit of a technical, I wouldn't even call it error. Like, she just didn't have enough time. I loved at judge's table, they said, how long did you cook the peas? And she said, the whole time. And they laughed. They were like, yeah, probably.
Checks out.
But so now let's move on to Shuai and Massimo, as I said, in the way I conceptualized this episode, took this the same, but the opposite approach to Cesar, Tristan, and Bailey, which was, they created dishes that were about the ingredients as they were in their natural form. They were not extrapolating to create something familiar. And so Shuai is our first example of this. He says that a lot of the medicinal flavors reminded him of soups and broths that his mom made for him. And he wanted to replicate that on the plate. So he made a roasted cabbage with rose hip glazed pork belly, sour cabbage broth, lovage, and thatching ant togarashi.
I have had so much fun the last three episodes with Shuai.
Yes. Not just because he's on our fantasy team.
Not just because of that. Shuai and Bailey. But he had a quote this episode and said, quote, whenever I cook from memory and love, it comes out well. And he locked into that sometime mid-season and has just been banger after banger. Like Kristen said it well. She's just, you know, the reason he had a bit of the edge ultimately is because it was just like it was presenting it in a way that I have never experienced and was never familiar with. And it's cabbage, and you're just elevating cabbage in that way. And and
Okay, so this is where
in the kitchen cook. Like,
yeah. So if we can jump ahead to judge's table. So Tom at the table said, I'm jealous I didn't make that dish. Insane praise. And then at judge's table, he puts a period on that sentence, which is, he said, it made me want to get in the kitchen and cook something.
Yeah.
The reason why this is such a remarkable thing to say is at this point in his career, Tom is a prolific restaurateur. He probably is not cooking in kitchens all that often. And for him to, at this stage, after 22 seasons, seeing what, you know, he probably feels like is every trick in the book, he gets excited and inspired by one of these contestants who is now, like, you know, many years his junior, in such a different place in their career. And this guy is giving him the spark. To me, the way that Tom, the reason why Tom said, like, I love this job is because you could just see in his eyes, he was so exhilarated by this challenge and this dish in particular.
And that goes, that kind of radiates in a lot of different directions too, right? Because we heard even Shuai himself say that in sort of the downtime with the other chefs at the beginning of the episode. He's like, I'm just so grateful for this experience because it has, it, like, I kind of thought I peaked. And just the external pressure and force of the excellence of people around you kind of pushing you into a completely new level of you is incredible. And that's 1,000%. I think that that's really the case across the board for everybody. Like, I think everybody's leaving a better chef than they came. And I guess Tom as well.
Well, okay, let's round it out by talking about Massimo, who I think at the beginning of this season, really the judges, I think, found Massimo's gregariousness a bit grating. And I think that they have so grown to love him and what he brings to the table, literally. And they, it's the type of thing where if anyone, like, Janet Zuccherini is going to say, like, this guy it has a really annoying tableside manner, I bet Kristen would throw blows to defend Massimo at this point. Like, no one's coming for him. You can't make fun of our friend like that. And, okay, sorry. I'm getting ahead of ourselves. Bits, tell us what Massimo made.
So before we get to even what he made, Massimo comes out, and this is, I think, just to continue on that thread, he comes out with this massive preamble about how David Bowie was once exploring monkhood, and the monk asked him three questions of which the judges, I guess, could hopefully answer. Like, just so weird. Like, I just love it. I love the showmanship.
Why?
But yeah. And I, and you're right. You're so right. It's sort of like when you, someone has like a very particular kind of annoying, and then you're like, no, that's just you. And I'm so glad you have that energy here. And we've been, look, not to say like we are, again, predictors of amazing things, but we kind of call it. We're like, this guy, this is a personality that TV needs right now. Save us. And so anyways, Massimo comes out. He made a beautiful looking grilled trout with mustard sauce. He was dialed in on the mustard. He was like, mustard.
Brilliant.
He had a smoked potato puree and a bannock with wild flour. The bannock, did you see him literally like making that on a rock?
On a stone.
Yeah, I love that. That was full caveman tilt.
Yeah. That was biblical bread right there.
But I actually, it's kind of interesting. So back to the David Bowie fun fact. We had two David Bowie mentions this episode.
Both what was the other one?
Bailey mentioned that she was like into glam rock.
Oh, yeah.
And David Bowie, which really actually checks out. Yeah, that actually, I know she thinks she doesn't bring that into her food. I actually would disagree with that because I think she just does like wild shit and kind of just does whatever she wants. And that's very glam rock. And then we hear Massimo. So David Bowie actually did consider becoming a Buddhist monk. I had to look this up after. I'm like, is this like some weird joke?
I believe
it. Punchline? But yeah, the monk literally said like, no, you should go, you should do music instead. So, but when he died, they scattered his ashes in Bali because he wanted to be, he wanted to be in Bali, be close to.
Well, shout out to that monk for giving humanity the gift of David Bowie.
Yeah,
and his art.
Shout out to Just Dance.
So Massimo makes this delicious dish. The fish is cooked perfectly. I loved when he said, like, it's so complicated to get the skin crispy and the fish cooked and all these things. He said, but this is not my first rodeo. Like, he knows he's going to nail it. He knows it. He, the way he was inserting the skewers into the trout, so thin, so beautiful.
I love the way that all the guests, Nancy, I completely skimmed over another leftover that I wanted to cover today, which was that I did see the Mission Impossible movie this weekend. So I'll use this opportunity to kind of tap into that because what I was going to say was the guest judges, the people who meet Massimo for the first time, love Massimo.
Yes.
The table this episode couldn't get enough of him.
Yes.
Buddha couldn't get enough of him.
Yes.
And the dude from the Mission Impossible, the actor, couldn't get enough of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll use this again. Like I said, quick plug for the Mission Impossible movie. It was the most movie I've ever experienced in my life. 3 hours long. Could have been an 8-hour television series that this man just put into one movie. There's like a full 30 minutes devoted to him diving into the Arctic depths to retrieve some MacGuffin that was submerged in a submarine. And the submarine, of course, is like on a precarious ocean shelf that is it is now rolling off of. So now Tom Cruise has to get out of the sub to swim up before the sub falls farther into the ocean. It was just unbelievable. So if you're on the fence, go watch it because it was hilarious. But the guy who was the guest judge was awesome.
Yeah.
He played that like character who's sort of like the, you know, when the kind of rogue guy is like, you don't want to do this. Like, we got to do it to save the world. And he's the one that's convinced. And so he's sort of like the straight cop that kind of like joins the ragtag group to save the day. You know, he's like the straight laced one. So yeah, he was good. But anyway, so Massimo.
Massimo. The feedback for Massimo is fish is cooked perfectly. He used the mustard well. The sauce is outstanding. The one piece of feedback he got is that the Bannock herb condiment, to your point,
condiment
was bitter and felt disconnected from the trout.
And they also did question whether mustard was like outside enough.
Yeah.
Because when it gets down to it, and you know, we'll sing the praises of Schwei and Tristan again, but it ultimately kind of came down to Bailey and to Massimo. And I do think that Bailey embraced it. You know, Bailey was full in on these are the flavors. I'm going to use them in weird ways. I don't know how much of that like kind of factored in here because, again, this was certainly like a splitting hairs going home for a great dish situation. Mm-hmm. But it was funny. I actually love – I think – this season's been interesting too because we have a feel for the feedback we can expect from Tom and sort of like have calibrated what Tom thinks is like, or calibrated how to read his feedback in terms of this was good, this was great, this was superb. Mm-hmm. Same goes for Gail. We can kind of expect what commentary to come. I think Gail's really good at fixating on like individual elements of the dish in a way that even more so than Kristen and Tom. I think Kristen's angle in a lot of ways that I see her taking is sort of the way that the food eats or like how to eat the food or assemble the bite.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. And you know what's funny? I also did a rewatch of that Boston season. I then did LA All-Stars, which Gregory Gourdet and Melissa King are on. And Padma, in retrospect, as we've now had two seasons of Kristen Kish, Kristen's better. Like, she really is. Padma is deeply critical. Deeply critical.
I kind of forgot that, too, until I started watching again.
Yeah, rewatching old seasons, you're like, damn, Padma, that's pretty cutting.
Her favorite thing to do was like, did you mean to do XYZ?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's a classic Padma.
Did you mean to blah, blah, blah?
But she would fixate, too, and I will not – like, I think her feedback was warranted most of the time. I don't – but I think that she just put a very dramatic, critical spin on it in a way that I think Kristen doesn't even touch with a 10-foot pole. Kristen adds a completely new dimension of critique to things.
Well, you know what it is? The distinction to me is, like, one assumes that everybody is idiots and they don't know how to, like, make a bite of food themselves. And it's sort of like, let's assume everybody operates at their lowest common – level of intelligence and denominator. It's like being a programmer. It's like, unless you have the, I'm gonna eat this exactly as it lies, and I'm not gonna use any sort of power of observation or context to understand that maybe I should recalibrate this. Even if I just think that there's, Kristen doesn't need. She's not going to hold them up on a technicality of that and be like, well, I had this was so much like it was really bitter. Okay, well, then have less of it on your next bite. Like, then it's fine. Like, yeah. So, I completely agree. That has definitely jumped out. And I just think that it's fun to hear her, and especially when her and Tom really kind of like,
yeah.
There was a comment last week on the steak episode, or the beef episode, where they were really kind of like saying the same thing. I don't know what it was, but it was a fun moment where you could kind of tell their like brainwaves are connected.
Yeah.
But
Schwei wins the episode and gets what I believe is the compliment of the century from Tom Colicchio.
Yeah.
Which was so beautiful. And then Cesar and Tristan are told that they're also safe. Of course, Cesar has the line of the episode, which is, how are you feeling about making it to the finals? And he says, I can't wait to tell my mom.
Oh.
And then Tristan repeats the line when they said, how are you feeling? But in a beautiful way that reminds you that Tristan suffered the loss of his father not like 2 weeks before this.
I know.
Which just was so beautiful. And again, we're having this huge swell of emotion at the end of the episode. The excitement for these three guys going to the finale is palpable. And then coupled with it is the bittersweet reality that either Massimo or Bailey are going home for their dish. And just, this killed me. I think it killed everyone there, but our hometown.
I mean, Kristen was crying.
Yeah.
And I think it was super emotional. And honestly, I was kind of like, oh, how is he going to take this?
So
clearly he was disappointed. I think the thing that really stuck with me from him was just, you know, what's next? I look forward to serving people every day for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And Tom got up and hugged him.
Ugh. And
this
he's
was
going
tough.
To Montreal.
He's going to Montreal.
Tom's got a lot of stops to make because Tom is like feeling gone too soon. I feel it for a lot of these people. Not even gone too soon, like gone and it's sad. And
yeah.
So I really did think we were going to see Massimo in the final.
I did too. I will say this is in no way a knock on Bailey, but I was surprised that Massimo didn't make the finale.
Yeah. I just think she just was a little bit more adventurous and maybe that was the tilt.
I agree.
But Nancy, we're eating that.
We're eating that. Oh my God. And the rock made bread.
The rock bread. Give me all rock bread. Can we also, I'm going to be honest. I don't have any judgy table.
I was going to say, I'm a happy camper. In the spirit of this, even if I had one in the spirit of this episode, I don't think it's appropriate to
I
do a judgy
agree.
Table.
This episode is a temple. But what I do want to drag for a second is what I'm seeing in the finale teaser.
Okay.
I shouldn't say drag, but like I had to laugh because I'm like, what is it with this show and getting Olympians on it? Like, why do we always have an Olympian and Paralympian challenge in a foreign country?
Well, what it is advertising for NBC, which like in perpetuity owns the IP for the Olympics.
I mean, I guess that is just like every 4 years. Yeah, we're going to, or every 2 years if it's summer.
It's their advertising juggernaut. They have no choice but to rep.
But the thing that I was, so shout out to me because I actually visited the venue that they are cooking at.
Did you?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's like a university there. It's like the oldest university in Milan, which I think, I don't know. I feel like every city claims that they have the oldest university in the world or in Europe or whatever. So this was like Milan's answer to
that. I think Bologna is the oldest university in Europe.
Oh, that's why I'm thinking of it because I was in Bologna before Milan.
Okay.
Right.
I believe that Afghanistan has the oldest university in the world.
Afghanistan nanny.
Precisely. So, wow, what an episode.
We got paddles. We have paddles. I don't know. I'm like nervous. I'm a little nervous for the finale.
I know. But we have Ali, who I'm so excited to see. It's going to be a great time in Italy.
God, that's right.
And Bailey's going to be like supercharged in Italy.
Oh, my God. I'm really sad Massimo didn't make it. I really, yeah, that breaks my heart. But wow, I can't wait to go to Milan. I just love Milan. Oh my God, Nancy. Okay. Incredible episode. Before we adjourn here, two plugs. please tune into our episode with Lana on Monday. It was a very cute time. And lastly, if you've been enjoying the pod this season, please leave us a review,
please,
or a little rating. Give us your stars. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever. It helps other people discover the pod. Mm-hmm. If you're enjoying the pod, talk about it. Tell your friends. We saw a really lovely post on Reddit, and we were like, oh, thank you. So we just love,
we love the
it.
Love. Thank you.
So much love going around tonight. I think we're in a touchy-feely headspace.
We
but,
really are. Well, with that, let's hope that we continue this joy and emotion in the finale, part one, next week on Compliments to the Chef.
Bye.